From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Barry Melton is my guest this week, also known as The Fish. Barry Melton was a member of the great rock band Country Joe and the Fish, with whom he played many great nights at the San Francisco haunts of the 1960s, and of course, Woodstock. He's one of the great guitarists, and it's a pleasure to say, Barry Melton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Are you a native of the Bay Area originally?
No, I'm not. I came to San Francisco when I was 17 years old. I was born in New York City.
Ah.
And actually Brooklyn, and moved to Southern California, the Los Angeles area, when I was 8. Lived there for 9 years. And then came to San Francisco when I was 17. I enrolled in San Francisco State University.
When did you start playing the guitar?
I started playing guitar when I was 5 years old. My parents were neighbors of the Woody Guthrie family in New York when I was
really
living there.
Did you know Woody Guthrie?
Well, yeah, my dad and Woody were friends. I can't say that Woody and I were friends, or that
since you were five,
paid all that much attention to kids. I've known Jack Elliott all my life. So, you know, I have some roots with the Guthrie family. I was in March Guthrie's dance school, which was in that part of Brooklyn. So it was kind of an enclave of, I guess the word today would be, progressive folks that my parents lived in. And
not communist, but maybe slightly communist?
Well, you used the word I didn't.
Okay.
I said progressive, but certainly progressive meaning left wing.
Right, right. And what were your musical influences? I mean, did you start playing, you know, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, or what was the thing you were playing originally?
Well, when I first began studying guitar, my teacher was a classical violinist with the New York Philharmonic. And so I learned how to read, I learned music theory, and he almost taught me, in effect, a violinist's approach to the guitar. But the music around me, my parents' music and the music of their friends, was American folk music, that kind of music.
So was it music that caused you to drop out of college? And
I did not intend to become a professional musician. I wanted to be a lawyer. My parents wanted me to be a musician. My parents had sort of trained me to become a musician. And who wants to do what their parents want them to do? Not me. It took me years to break from my parents' influence and finally become a lawyer, which is what I wanted to do in the first place.
So they forced you to wear that orange flowing shirt and drop acid.
Exactly. That was their idea. No, they didn't really. Actually, they would have preferred, I believe, a blue Penny's work shirt and sort of proletarian garb.
Uh-huh.
Not anything remotely connected with spirituality or the counterculture or drug use or anything like that. My parents were not into that. My parents were very definitely sort of very sober, militant, left-wing people. My dad worked very hard in the troop migration process for the American brigades in the Spanish Civil War. And one of my uncles actually was a volunteer in the Washington Brigade. And they were pretty sober, serious folks.
Mm-hmm.
Although very progressive folks.
But before the end of 1965, you were The Fish. How'd you become known as The Fish?
Joe and I recorded together for the first time. Really, the first time the band, so to speak, ever got together was for our first recording, which was one side of a two-sided extended play, 33 and a third, 7-inch record.
It's legendary now, of course.
And on one side was a singer-songwriter by the name of Peter Krug, K-R-U-G, singing a song called Fire in the City, which was about the burning of Watts and the burning of the ghetto. And on the other side were two songs by, quote, Country Joe and the Fish, unquote, one of which was a jug band version of the I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag.
Well, come on, generals, and let's move fast. Your big chance has come at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, because the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when we're blowing them all to kingdom come. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next up is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
And the other one was a duo, Joe and I playing guitars, me on electric guitar, him on acoustic, doing a song called Superbird, which was about Lyndon Johnson.
How did you guys meet?
We met at that recording session, actually, sort of. He called me up at the recommendation of a mutual friend. He was looking for a guitar player to record with him on this EP. He was co-publishing a small newsletter in the Bay Area called Rag Baby, which was a folk music magazine, I guess, for want of a better word, and this was going to be a talking edition of the folk music magazine. So we met together, we rehearsed a couple of times, I went out and rented an electric guitar and amplifier, and went and did the session, and then, lo and behold, the record came out in conjunction with the first teach-ins against the war in Vietnam that were held in Berkeley in 1965, and we had the record out. We staffed a table down in Sproul Plaza in front of UC Berkeley, and we sold these EPs for $1 a piece, and ultimately somebody came along from the SDS and booked the two of us on a tour. And
so you were just a duo, Country Joe and the Fish.
Yeah, that's it.
Uh-huh.
And for obvious reasons, because Joe's name was Joe, the name Country Joe stuck to him. So I must have been the fish, I guess.
Yeah. And then when did the rest of the band, I mean, how did it become a rock band?
Well, slowly, but surely.
Mm-hmm.
We played as a duo for a while. And then we played for a while with just a bass player, a fellow named Richard Saunders, who still plays music in the Bay Area. He teaches at, I believe, the Blue Bear School of Music. And Richard plays klezmer music, I believe, as well. And is still playing in the Bay Area. He played stand-up bass with us. And that's the configuration that we were working with when we did our first real big concert with Allen Ginsberg and the Fugs at the Life Science Building in Berkeley at the university. And then one night we got really whacked, and we went and saw the Paul Butterfield Blues Band play at the Pauley Ballroom on the campus of UC Berkeley. And we said, man, we ought to be doing that. Took a look at Mike Bloomfield, who I knew actually from an earlier incarnation. And so we slowly began assembling an electric band. We had a guy named John Francis Gunning on the drums. He's the drummer who appears on our first electric EP, which followed the first acoustical one I talked to you about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fellow named Paul Armstrong who was playing bass most of the time. And the picture of our first electric EP is in front of Paul's Goodwill truck. Paul became a conscientious objector, and his way of getting out of serving in the military for the Vietnam War was to drive a Goodwill truck. Paul eventually gave away to Bruce Barthol, who is a high school friend of mine and my roommate. Bruce had been alternating playing bass and playing tambourine and stuff. And ultimately, I was working in another band with a guy named Dave Cohen who came and joined us. And so the original band on the EP, the first EP, was Dave Cohen, Paul Armstrong, Bruce Barthol, and John Francis Gunning, Joe and me.
Talking with Barry Melton, who was the Fish of Country Joe and the Fish, what role did LSD play in your musical configuration?
You know, that's an interesting question, because arguably it didn't play any role at all except to get us stoned, and to, I mean, you know, and then to have a bunch of stoned people on stage at various times.
Uh-huh.
I have made the argument that, musicologically speaking, there really is no direct influence of drugs other than to get musicians loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what you have in that era in the 60s, and particularly in the Bay Area, is, and this is true of early Grateful Dead music or Country Joe and the Fish or Jefferson Airplane, it's really folk rock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's folk rock blended with jazz influences and Eastern music influences to the extent that it also became a sort of improvisational kind of folk rock.
Right.
Using the base of folk music as its point of departure, and then taking that assumption and extending it into improvisation that had previously been the province of jazz. It was a natural place for young white musicians from the West Coast to go with their music.
I guess your folk rock roots are why you ended up on Vanguard Records. How did Vanguard get involved
there?
Actually,
I wouldn't say it was so much our folk rock roots as our political band.
Were you guys the first electric band that Vanguard signed?
We may well have been. I don't know if we were the first artist to actually play electric music. I'm thinking of Eric Anderson and people who recorded on the label at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they had Sandy Bull, and he was doing some electric music.
Did they treat you well, Vanguard?
Both Maynard and Seymour, who own the label, are gone now. It's actually owned now by Lawrence Welk's son.
What a perfect fit.
And it's part of the Welk group, Vanguard is. And they actually have some degree of sensitivity or appreciation for the music and its historical significance. And I think they've been kind to us and Joan Baez and other people who were on the label at that time. You know, Vanguard let us do our thing in terms of our expression. And
they let you include a game board.
Yeah, they did.
Did you ever play that game? Did anybody play the game?
Yeah, you can't win. It goes nowhere, honestly. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about Woodstock, since the anniversary recently occurred. What are your memories of Woodstock?
I'll tell you, I have more memories of Woodstock now, after going through this 40th anniversary, than I have for the last 10 years or so, anyway.
It dredged up forgotten memories, or what?
Yeah, I mean, sort of dredged up because people have been asking me about it, and I've been doing a certain amount of media in connection with it, and it's brought up some memories.
Mm-hmm.
I have a distinct memory now of flying over to the site on the day of our performance with this sort of young, frightened-looking musician with curly hair in the helicopter with me, who I had no idea of who he was or what he did. Turned out his name was Joe Cocker, and he was pretty good.
Wow.
And, you know, I remember flying over the treetops on the way to the site and seeing how many thousands and thousands and thousands of people were in the woods, camped in the woods. And we have this visual picture of Woodstock and figure, boy, that's a big crowd. You know?
Yeah.
But I think that the real size of the crowd is really underestimated because people have this visual picture of this number of people there within sight of the stage. And I want to tell you that, I don't know, 30, 40, 50% of the audience couldn't be seen from the stage because they were in the woods.
Mm-hmm. Which means they couldn't see you either.
That's probably true, and I'm not sure whether they could have heard us either, or maybe all they heard was stray bass tones,
mm-hmm.
which carry over a far longer distance than anything else in the band.
How do you feel about the performance of Country Joe and the Fish at Woodstock?
You know, our performance wasn't great, and one of the reasons why they ended up using footage of Joe as a solo is because we went on right after the rainstorm, and we had a lot of technical and equipment problems as a result of the rainstorm. Our stuff got rained on. And so when they were trying to rescue usable material from our set, it turned out to be easier to use the performance of Joe as a solo, which didn't have any technical problems.
Well, of course you are in the film, and you look fantastic with that great shirt you're wearing.
Yeah, and by the way, no one can prove what I was smoking in that.
That's right. So Country Joe and the Fish lasted until the early 1970s. What happened to the band?
We lasted time one till about 1971, maybe into teeny, tiny bit of 1972. And then the band broke up, and then it reformed, and then it broke up, and it reformed. And we went through about another decade of schizophrenia, where the band would reform for periods of time and then stop working for periods of time. We recorded the reunion album in 1976 for Fantasy Records, which was about, I believe it's the only real reconstitution of anything approaching the earlier versions of the band. We did appear in the movie More American Graffiti.
Right.
And we're on that soundtrack with another version of the band with other players. People who had been playing in my band during that period are in that version of Country Joe and the Fish. So, yeah, it was kind of on again, off again until, I'd say, 81, 82. And then in 82, I joined a band called Dinosaurs.
Right.
And actually, Joe was our opening act on a number of our shows over the course of the several years that I played in Dinosaurs.
Are you guys still friendly? Do you get along and so forth?
We don't communicate with one another all that much. So I couldn't say we don't get along, because I don't think I've talked to Joe in almost 2 years.
But then eventually you disappointed your parents and became a lawyer.
Absolutely true. You know, and that's what I wanted to be all along. I mean, I'm the guy who chose to study semantics because I thought it would make an ideal pre-law curriculum.
So how old were you when you got your law degree?
I became a lawyer when I was 35.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't ever go back to college. I mean, I have 10 weeks of college, period. I passed a college equivalency test in connection with registering as a law student with the state bar. And ultimately, I studied independently for both a Bachelor of Laws degree and a doctorate in jurisprudence. I studied on the road via correspondence with unaccredited schools.
And then you practiced law?
In 1982, I passed the bar. I became a lawyer. I've been in legal practice ever since 1982. I would say the first 4 or 5 years that I was practicing law, it was kind of, well, the first year I practiced, it was 10% law and 90% music. And next year it was 20% law, 80% music, you know.
And what about now?
Well, I just retired from my post as the public defender of Yolo County. So I expect I'll put a little bit more music back in the mix. I would say I was running at around 85-15 law to music, and maybe I'll get back to a place where it's closer to 50-50, which in some ways is the time that I look most fondly back on.
Was the 50-50 time?
Yeah, but I was working 60, 70 hours a week, and I'm over 60 now, so I'm not looking forward to having a schedule like that anymore. When I was playing with Dinosaurs, we were working 4 or 5 nights a week in the Bay Area, and I was practicing law 5 days a week. So there were a lot of times where I'd work till 1:30 in the morning. I'd drive home, I'd sleep for 4 hours, I'd wake up, I'd go to court, drive home as soon as court was over, take a nap, go back to court maybe, take another nap, go out and play music at night. So, I mean, pretty grueling schedule, which I don't know if I'd really want to do that now.
But you are playing music. People could catch you live.
I have dates here and there. You know, I have a website, BarryMelton.com will work. It's the easiest one to say. But I only post on the website dates that I consider to be mine, where I'm the kind of featured attraction. I spend several nights out a month sitting in with my friends, to keep my my chops up. But I don't post all of those to the website, and I particularly don't want to post them because I don't want to have to be there if I...
If you decide you're too tired, you want to take a nap.
You got it.
Well, Barry Melton, the Fish of Country Joe and the Fish, been our guest this week. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's all for this edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Check us out on Facebook or iTunes or at our podcast page at KUSP.org. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.